Kids, this is KJ, and I feel, stop me if I'm wrong here, that perhaps you or someone you love would enjoy reading one of my books. You can't go wrong with The Chicken Sisters, a tale of rival fried chicken restaurants and rival sisters in a small town trying to solve all their problems via reality TV. Always a good idea. And many readers like In Her Boots even better. That one's a fun story about figuring out who you are as opposed to who you think everyone wants you to be, that also delivers a literary hoax, a farm life, and an ex who can't seem to find the exit. Or give future you or anyone you love a lovely gift by pre-ordering Playing the Witch Card for next Halloween's witchy reading fun. Bookstores, people, head to one now.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Him Writing, the weekly podcast about getting all your writing things done. Short things, long things, fiction. I guess you could get fishes done. I'm not sure how that would work out. Let's go with fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals, whatever you're working on. We are here to help you, do that thing with ideas and stuff. And I am your only host today. I'm KJ Delantonia, the author of 3 novels, as well as 1 nonfiction book, and also a former editor with the New York Times. And you probably know all that at this point. And with me is Amy Bernstein, who is going to introduce herself. But I will also add that she is one of the fantastic coaches who is helping people move through our Blueprint for a Book winter program, which we will be doing again in the summer. So if you're sorry to have missed out on that and you love hearing from Amy, you're going to get another shot if she'll do it again. We're going to probably, she doesn't have to commit to that now.
Twist my arm.
I think she will. All right. Amy, please introduce yourself, and then we're going to talk about this in like the general way and the meta way. But I'll explain that in a second.
I love general and meta. It's good. Thank you, KJ. And I'm really, really glad to be on with you. As you noted, I am an author accelerator certified book coach, working with a variety of nonfiction clients and some memoir clients. I'm also a former journalist. I'm also a novelist. And now I have a nonfiction book out, Wrangler, the Doubt Monster, which I know we'll talk about. And I teach a lot of writing workshops and some really exciting new creativity workshops. So I am all over the map.
Yes. So we're here because I definitely want to talk about Wrangling the Doubt Monster. And the biggest way that I want to talk about Wrangling the Doubt Monster is the actual meat, the wrangling of said doubt monster. This is your book about how every writer and creative has doubts at all times, and really that the goal is to learn to live with and use those doubts rather than to hope that somehow you will suddenly become doubt-free, which is not really reasonable. And I want to really focus on that. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be what we're going to be working on today, is like our little internal selves. But at the end, I'd also like to talk some about the process of creating this book, which is a small, illustrated, sort of, open it wherever you want and get something out of it book, something along the line of Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art, if anybody out there is a fan of that one, and I suspect a lot of you are. So I wanted to talk about the process of deciding to do that and creating it. But let's start with the doubts themselves and why you decided that the world needed an entire book about doubts when, they're really just nothing. Ha ha.
Nothing. Well, I guess I can start by saying I am on a mission to normalize conversations around doubt and self-doubt, because it's a very vulnerable set of emotions that we experience. And, we're in a culture that really wants to highlight success and sort of sweep all the scary stuff under the rug. And we need to own up to the fact that if we're out here making art or aspiring to make art in any form, or even start a company, you could be an entrepreneur and be very creative, you're going to be filled with doubt about the enterprise and about yourself. We ought to be giving voice to this, partly because we need to recognize we're not alone in these feelings. This is a universal experience. And I think that by sharing some of this, by normalizing it, by putting words to these feelings, we can really help to come to grips with the hold that doubt can have on us or over us.
So do you have any specific experiences of the doubt taking over for you?
Absolutely. My whole life. I can give you so many examples. So let me pluck one out from decades of doubting, okay? My entire professional career, I've always put my writing skills to use. I've literally earned my living that way for decades, not just as a journalist, but in government communications, in a lot of different facets. Whatever job I had, I was writing. I was always writing. It's what I was doing. It's what I was paid to do. I could not call myself a writer. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it until I was probably well into my 50s, after I started writing plays and getting some plays produced, after even self-publishing my very first novel to prove that I could do it, prove to myself that I could do it. Couldn't call myself a writer. Couldn't do it. It's like, I'm not a writer.
What did you call yourself?
Not that. It's like, oh, I'm a communications manager. Oh, look, I wrote a play, but I'm not a playwright, writer, person. Other people, that's for other people. So I think that, and I know I'm not alone. Other people have had this similar experience. And I think that that is just one facet of how doubt burrows in and manifests itself in our core identity so deeply. I'm not a writer. Writers are those other people out there doing amazing things. I'm not doing that. I can't possibly lay claim. Well, of course, now. I'll call myself a writer when, right. There's that. They ain't even.
And you're always raising that bar.
Yes. Yes. Yep. Yep. Classic example.
So why, I mean, I've got to pull my doubting self together, where I'm asking myself, how can we best help listeners to recognize this in ourselves? And I mean, what can people do? I mean, should we be trying to get rid of this, or should we be trying to harness it?
There absolutely are things that we can do. There are steps that we can take to enable us to walk with doubt, which is an accommodation. We cannot banish our doubts, but we can allow doubt not to be the loudest or the only voice in our head, because it never is the loudest or only voice in our head. It is one voice. We have other voices that are telling us that we can do something, reminding us of the accomplishments that we do have, the skill sets that we do have. So some of this is kind of changing the channel, so to speak, and adjusting the volume on the voices in your head. That is one step, but only one that you can take. And I think that goes hand in hand with a really key starting point, which is you need to give yourself permission to be a creator and to create and to acknowledge that this is who you are and what you want to do. And that while you may doubt your ability, you may doubt your competence, you may doubt your talent, you are going to give yourself permission to get out there and try and experiment and fall down and get up and try again. Doubt really manifests itself in so many ways. It's procrastination, it's depression, it's anxiety, it's these feelings of lack of confidence. I think it's aspects of imposter syndrome, although I think that's actually something different. And so it has a way of, fear, it has a way of manifesting in so many different emotional levels and speeds. But it really all comes around to this notion of, can I? Should I? Am I good enough? It all swirls back around to that. And so, you know, you have to begin by giving yourself permission to listen to other voices in your head and not just one. And there are other tips as well that we can get into, but that's a starting point.
So it feels like, you know, doubt sort of goes hand in hand with fear and with, I can't remember what Stephen Pressfield does call it in The War of Art, but it's just making me, it's giving me so strongly that whole idea that there's something in us that doesn't want us to do this. And I know that fear, like Elizabeth Gilbert has described that as being a protective force. But I feel like doubt is sounding a little less protective and a little more external. What do you think? Is it a little more other people's voices?
There absolutely is a protective aspect to doubt. And one example I often think about is if you think about a surgeon who pauses to consult a colleague before making an incision on a patient. There's a moment of doubt and hesitation there for all the right reasons, right? We're checking in on what's the right thing to do here. What's the right step? Am I in the right frame of mind? Do I have the right tool in my hand or whatever the thing may be? So doubt does have positive protective qualities. The problem is when we cocoon ourselves within a set of excuses, and I don't mean that in a judgmental way because we all do it and we can't help it, where we just back away, right? We just, I'm not going to try that. I'm not going to do that, or I'm not going to attempt it. And that really is doubt kind of taking over your decision-making process. And we have to find ways to take back our decision-making process so that we can take more creative risks a little bit more freely. And we may still feel doubtful about the outcome or about our ability, but we're going to go forward and take those creative risks anyway. It's very much a duality. It's very much a contradictory mindset. And we have to accept that those contradictions live within us.
It's not easy.
No.
I feel like some of us maybe are used to not listening or not letting the doubt take over, and it's kind of a practice. Like it takes a while, I would imagine. Let's talk about what some of the first things that someone who does who's recognized themselves in this, who is like, oh yeah, the doubt is what's holding me back from, you know, from starting this thing or from finishing this thing. I mean, that's a really common one. How many writers do we think are out there with, something where they just keep rewriting the beginning of something or mm-hmm. rewriting the middle and never getting to the end. So give us some little tiny steps people could take to just start moving past this.
Yes. I will share some steps, and I want to reiterate something you said because it's true. First of all, this is hard to do. It does not happen all at once. I think that these shifts, it's a mindset shift that does require small steps first. You don't necessarily see a change right away. But one of the images that I use, it's sort of like when Dorothy is in her dilapidated old farmhouse bedroom when she lands on Oz and she's in this black and white world. You know, she opens that door really cautiously and she steps out really gingerly. It's this process of allowing yourself to open that door a crack and walk through it. And I want to emphasize before I get to the tips part that we can do this because deep down we want to. I know that I have worked with clients on writing projects who they may wind up in tears and they're saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. But they do it. Then they do the thing. They make the revision, they finish the chapter, they write better, they have a breakthrough. They do it because deep down they want to, and because they finally get to that place where they are still full of doubt, but they're listening to the other voices that also let them acknowledge that they can. So that's the duality, and I just kind of want to hammer that home because it's a difficult place to be, but a very real place to be. So a few other things that you can do. A really big one is, well, a couple big ones. First of all, go back to your why as a creator and as a creative person. Why are you making art? Why are you an artist? Where is the passion and the joy? You know, that's deep within you. You need to connect back with your own motivating juices and forces as to why you're out here doing this thing anyway, whether it's writing or whatever creative risk you're taking. Because doubt... becomes this sort of cloud or bubble that you dwell in that masks these other very positive forces, such as, I have a passion to write the story. Don't lose sight of that. You need to remember that. Reconnect with that. You know, what really matters to you as a maker, right? Something else that's really important that we don't spend enough time on in our own lives, personally and professionally, is really recognizing who your allies are and who your adversaries are, and making sure that you surround yourself with allies that can be individuals, institutions, communities of people who really support and encourage you to go ahead and walk with those doubts and take those creative risks, as opposed to adversaries in your life who may be people you love deeply and who love you, who are constantly saying, why are you doing that? That seems silly. That seems like a waste of time. I don't think you should be doing that. I think you've worked at this enough. You know, 5 years and nothing's happened. I think you should move on. You need to dial down the adversarial voices, because they're only augmenting the doubts you already have. And you need to dial up the ally voices, because that's what you need to be surrounded by, which is what book coaches do too, by the way. Right? We're very much allies for working with our clients. So that those are some really important things to do. And I want to add one more thing, which is we live in a culture that is fixated on very specific measures of productivity and success. There's certain ways that we look at progress. We look at money that you earn. We look at specific outcomes in the nature of tangible products and services that we can touch, buy, feel, see. When you're an artist or any kind of a creator, those outputs and outcomes may have absolutely nothing to do with you making art. And we need to decouple our own expectations as artists from these traditional productivity measures. They're not relevant. And you're just going to make yourself feel like you're failing, which only exacerbates your sense of doubting. You know, this notion of, well, I didn't write 50,000 words this week, or I didn't finish the book by September 1, like I said. You know, we have to sever this notion that we absolutely must meet these conventional productivity measures, which don't necessarily have a place in art making and can, in fact, militate against it. So those are some things.
I think we even here on the podcast are sometimes guilty of pushing those measurements without talking about the reality of them for us. Which is that we recreate how we earn our mental day's success with every week. So a really common thing to hear us talk about is 1,000 words a day. And sometimes that's the measure, and sometimes it's 2 hours of thinking, and sometimes it's getting a certain thing done. As I look back at some of the ways that we have measured ourselves, I hope we didn't do too big a disservice to people by putting those expectations on them. But the real thing that I wanted to bring into this is this, as you talk about doubts, and we're kind of looking at it from like a new writer's perspective, but I want to note that this is also huge for people who have been published or had some success, because an insidious thing with our internal doubts is that once you've had some success, you feel like maybe your doubts are smarter. Do you follow me? It's like, well, I published that one book, so now I'm thinking this one sucks, and I'm probably right because I probably know that it isn't as good as the thing that I published. So I probably should. It's almost like you listen to them more. Right. Like you're giving your negative worst self more credence,
right?
Because of your own. Yeah, that's a genius thing. I did.
Yeah, that's a fascinating spin. I think that's a very real thing. Our doubts get too smart for us, and you know, it can lead to more like paralyzing you even more in some ways, because you throw out every page that you've written because you know it's terrible. Yeah. But the other thing
is, I've done this.
The other thing is, which would, you know, look, KJ, you're successful by all the things that we sort of consider successful to look like. And, you know, I think this is where imposter syndrome also comes in. And I draw a real distinction. To me, imposter syndrome, and there are marvelous books about this out there specifically. Kim Menninger has written one that I really admire. I think when you've had some success, and you can define that any way you want. Then you the kind of doubt that creeps in is a special brand that says, well, wait a minute. I'm not really all that everybody thinks that I am. Yeah, I did that thing, but that doesn't mean I can do the next thing or the next big thing, or I'm not this big thing that everybody says that I am, despite the fact that I clearly have this success. So I think imposter syndrome comes in when you start feeling like you're not sure you've earned it, and you think that people's expectations of you are rapidly outstripping who you really see yourself as. It's like a disconnect. I think that's different from.
I agree. That's not what we're talking
from
about.
From fundamental
here.
Doubt. But I mean, this is all on its own spectrum, right? Of part, it's all part of the human condition, which is that, you know, we are insecure creatures in many, many, many ways. And, you know, that's the way we are. That's the way we're wired.
Yeah. We need success, and we need to feel like we're fitting into the tribe in a way that, you know, earns us our daily ration of nuts and berries, I guess. It's purely natural. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the book itself, which is adorable. It's a little, I don't know, Serena would know the trim size right off, but it's, you know, it's almost a square, and it's fun, and it's illustrated, and it's at any moment that you open it, it comes at you with a positive quote about guilt or a doubt, positive vision of, or not guilt, I'm sorry, about doubt, or a positive vision about
slip.
How, was it, you think?
I think there's something
there. Yeah, I think it might be the little monster in your illustrations.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what it looks like. Why did you decide to do it like this, and how did it feel to pull it together?
Right. So the end product, so the book is roughly 5x5. It is pretty small. Hopefully it sits up on the It's supposed to sit up on that point of purchase stand, like in the bookstore, right? Or the gift store or something.
Sure.
The end product is a really interesting partnership between me and my publisher. And so we both contributed vision to the final sort of look and feel. But let me back up. It's, you know, creation is a mysterious thing. I think I'd been thinking about this topic for a long time before I started writing. And then I got into it extremely intensively, and I was obsessed. I was working on it every day for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And for those who don't know the book, it's almost a hybrid of narrative prose and poetry. And I don't want to put anybody off and say, oh, it's a book of poems. That is not what it is. But it's sort of a poetical prose. And I just feel that form followed function. I put the words down the way I needed them to be, in the form that I needed them to be. And so it took on a life of its own in terms of the form, like telling me what it needed to be. And then once I found my publisher, Bancroft Press, I think I said, you know, I really think it lends itself to illustrations. And he said, that's a great idea. And so he had an illustrator that he worked with, and we worked on that and tweaked some of that. And so he really wanted to lean into the whimsy and the playfulness. I was like, all dead serious. This is a serious topic. This is difficult stuff. It's like, he's like, yeah, well, you know, we can lighten this up. It's like, can we? Should we? But we did. And I'm really glad we did, because it's a balance between dark and light, as well, I think it should be. And it's approachable. So it was a kind of an amalgamation of things. But honestly, you know, what is that answer as to when a writer writes something in a certain form, why did she write it that way? It just springs up.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, you described it as prose poetry, and I can see that, but it also reminds me very strongly of, for example, Gretchen Rubin has a small trim-sized book about, Outer Order Intercom. And it's like every page is just a thought about it, and some of them are as small as, if you put your pens in a tray, they're going to look nicer. And some of them are more like, we cling to our things because, you know, really. And this book is very much like that. Some of these are like a really thoughtful, you know, words from you about the depth of doubt and the emotion that we feel within us. And some of them are more like, and also, you know, sometimes you can envision to yourself putting that voice in a little box and setting it off to the side. That's, I think, not an example, but I think the way that you created this is really useful for the topic, because I don't know, to sit down and read like 300 pages on this would be a very, it would be a different book. It would have to have a lot of like, and here's the social sciences around it, and here's the experiments that were done, and those things are all in there, but they're not necessarily useful in the moment. What you've done is to try to give someone things, something that's useful in the moment.
I'm really glad you said that. One of my early readers, of the advanced reader copy is a guy who spent his whole life in business. He's a serial entrepreneur. He started a ton of companies. And I was really curious to see what he would think of this. And he said, my gosh, I wish I'd had this book 20 years ago, because I was going through these long, dense books, you know, as about, you know, like the science or the social science and then this and then that. He said, this is like the quick hit, kind of goes right to the bloodstream. And I was aiming for that. I wanted a real directness. I wanted you to be able to, as you say, you should be able to open any page that's like, that, and not have to, you know, read from the first line. And that weren't taking on a big commitment. We have a lot of books like that out there. And I did want to sort of buck that trend. And I did. It's petite.
So because we are a podcast for writers, what was the process of pitching something like this like?
I did try to get an agent for the piece first. And let me back up. As a certified book coach, I am in nonfiction. I really know my way around a book proposal. And I was very confident about my book. I was like, oh, goody, I get to write a book proposal for me. And I was so excited about doing it. I love that. And I'm helping other writers do that. And I love that. So I wrote a pretty darn good book proposal. I just will say that. And at least one agent came back and said, you know, I really like this. And then she said, what's your platform? It's just so small. Go away she said to me, oh, go away for a year and build your platform and then come back. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. And so I do think that is what I get it. I understand that you can't walk me over to Simon & Schuster or Hachette or something and go, oh, look what we have. Because, you know, my platform is modest. It is what it is and I'm fine with it. And it's growing in its own way, right? But that was the thing. That was the thing, I think, that put some of the agents off. And then I was reminded Bancroft Press is a small independent publisher. He's been around since the early 1990s. He's really got staying power. Agents are bringing him a lot of really major properties right now that the big five aren't taking. They're going down the food chain with sort of great novels and stuff. It's really interesting. And he's a really, really collaborative partner with an author. So it's been a great, great relationship.
So you ended up going straight to Bancroft.
I did.
Good for you. Yeah. I mean, I love hearing that you got the platform speech. And I think so many nonfiction writers have gotten the platform speech. And what's crazy is, I mean, I think writers at all kinds of levels of what you might see as platform get the platform speech because, you know, we're not mega famous singers and writers, and yet we have also seen, and now I have completely blanked on it, but platform does not equal book sales.
That's so right. It does not.
Yeah, I wanted to talk. There's the one musician who wrote
the Britney Spears
wrote a book that
Britney,
she got.
The Britney Spears
no,
one.
No,
that didn't,
no, no. Britney Spears'
sell?
Book did just
oh,
fine.
Oh, I thought that was the one no. that didn't. Yeah, one of there's one of them
no,
that didn't.
No,
yeah.
It was yeah. It's someone else. I probably won't find it and put in the okay. show notes, but someone will recognize it because we absolutely talked about it here. She's more indie, but also enormously popular, but not in a way that necessarily sells books. I mean, it kind of comes back to the thing that we often say, which is nothing sells books, but books still sell, which really just means no one knows.
Well, I will say that, you know, I do as much trend spotting as I can about what's going on in publishing and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. And I did see somebody, I don't remember who, somebody wrote flat out, well, the agents are finally, and the agents and the maybe the publishers are finally recognizing that in nonfiction expertise counts, maybe more than platform. Like if you know your stuff mm-hmm. and you can write a great book about the stuff that you know, with a great case for the book, that matters. And that's what I'm working on with all of my clients. You know, it's like, let's make the best case that we can. I'm not worried about your platform. Let's make the best case we can for this, why this book needs to live in the world, right? And then, you know, the platform pieces.
Yeah.
Can't be the be-all.
I like that. I think expertise matters is maybe the new nonfiction motto
and
around
here. And the old one used to be...
And that's true. Own your expertise. We've always said that.
Yeah.
But now, also, expertise over platform.
Right.
Let's, please.
Yes, please.
I would much rather, read a book by a good expert than one by a famous person who, anyway, that's fine. All right. Well, this has been really great. You know that most of the time when we interview someone, we like to finish with what we've been reading. So, other than Wrangling the Doubt Monster, which I just read, what have you read lately that you've really enjoyed?
I am in the middle of a novel that is self-published by a childhood friend of mine. And I can't say much about it yet because I'm not far enough along. But I will just say that reading that brings so much up for me about the choices we make to self-publish and how that affects the way a book is and what's mm-hmm. in that book and would this have been a different book had it gone a traditional route. And so I read in this book and I'm thinking about that on every page in a lot of interesting ways. And so that's where I am with that.
I think that's a funny thing that like most readers aren't going to think about. When I read a book, depending on who the there are times when I know who the publisher was or who the editor was for some reason, and I'll read it in a different way, sort of asking myself, well, would this have been different had it come out in from a different place? But most readers, should we say normie readers, regular readers?
Yeah, don't think that's what I'm thinking about.
Don't think about that. Don't think about that stuff. If they, you know, come across it, wherever they come across it and they buy it, they typically have little to no idea how it was published.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah. Well, that's been on my nightstand for a while. And just to be really honest, I just haven't had a tremendous amount of time to read for pleasure lately. So I'm between bigger books. And I tend to go through these periods where I was an English literature major with a concentration in Vic Lit, as we say, Victorian literature. Mm-hmm. And I never stopped loving that period. So when I need comfort food, I'll go back to Thackeray or Edith Wharton or even Henry James. That's where I just go for, I just know I'm going to love it. I'm going to love something about it. And so I've been dipping into that canon lately as well.
Well, so I'm going to tell you something that I just bought, which I have not yet read. The Making of a Marchioness by Frances Hodgson Burnett,
who's
the author
classic
of The Secret Garden.
Yes.
I know.
Yeah.
And I, so there's a publishing house that a particular bookstore is, I believe it's called Persephone, or maybe it's just a publishing line. And there's a bookstore in Boston called Beacon Hill Books, mm-hmm. and they have a whole shelf of these. And what they are like, you would call them commercial fiction mm-hmm. from the time period that they were published that they have brought back. So this was like, you know, in its day, The Making of a Marchioness was huge, apparently, you know. And so they've brought that back. And there's a whole shelf of these from different eras. Right. It's a really interesting shelf. And I'm sure you can get these books in other ways. And I will put that in the show notes.
That is cool. Yeah. No. I also, I'm just fascinated by how what we consider commercial literature has changed in a century and a half. I mean, that's a whole topic for another time, but it's fascinating to read, to read what was considered popular fiction at the time, which now would be considered heavy growing literary fiction in some respects.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's really, and I've read, a decent amount of Thackeray and Trollope and that sort of thing. And the amount of time that they could spend on a mm-hmm. particular scene mm-hmm. or within in a character's head or mm-hmm. or on the appearance of, I mean, it's just totally different and really interesting. And then, of course, you have to think about the process of writing, which did not involve cut and paste, you know?
Mm-hmm.
like to correct something was so so we were getting more, you know, a more direct line into the writer and less of a precisely created product. It is really interesting. Well, yeah, as you said, a topic for another time. Podcast. Yep. So, all right, we're not doing a great job of recommending books here, people. You'll just have to go and read Wrangling the Doubt Monster. Sorry. I've been unable to finish a lot of things lately.
I'm glad to hear you say that. It's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it's me or the moment. I have read some great things. Y'all should be subscribing to my Am Reading newsletter if you want to hear about those, because I'm just not feeling them in this exact moment. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a tough time for reading.
Yeah, that happens.
All right. Well, this was really fantastic. You all can find Wrangling the Doubt Monster pretty much anywhere just by Googling it, and also by checking our show notes for all the available links. Where can people best follow you, Amy?
Basically, my website. You can join my mailing list or just peruse the website. It's amywrites.live, amywrites.live.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Thank you, KJ.
And I'm going to close this off like we always do. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop. Aww. Thank you.